good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, where we're doing our oral arguments this morning on Zoom.gov. It is July 22nd, 2021. Marshall, will you call the second case?
The next case on the calendar is number 821-0068, Brian Earl Grogg, petitioner appellant versus Karen Lynn Reck, respondent.
And for the record, the panel before you is Judge Lucinda Jessen. I'm residing, Judge Diane Bretwald, and Judge Denise Riley. The procedures are very much the same as they would be in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. It asks you to introduce yourself for the beginning of your arguments, because we are recording these and making our recordings of oral arguments available on our website. And finally, if you have technical problems, let us know. We'll stop and try and get them resolved. You'll also notice in that regard that there is a square on your Zoom screen with a clock that will let you know how much longer you have in the time allotted to you. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Good morning. Jill Frieders on behalf of the appellant, Brian Grogg. The issues today are, what is the standard for modification of child support based upon the emancipation of a child? Is the emancipation in and of itself the basis for the modification? Or, in addition to the emancipation, does the obligor also need to show that there has been a substantial change in circumstances that renders the provisions of the previous order unreasonable and unfair? Under either analysis, Dr. Grogg has shown that there should be a modification of child support. 518A.39, subdivision 2, indicates that child support may be modified based upon the emancipation of a child as provided in subdivision 5. Subdivision 5 indicates that when there is one child support order and there are more than one children, and the oldest child emancipates, or a child emancipates, the obligor may bring a motion to modify support, and support shall be determined based on the income of the parties at the time of the motion. So based on this, Dr. Grogg brought the motion to modify child support when the eldest child emancipated. There are two remaining children. And the district court indicated that emancipation alone is not a basis for modification, and indicated that it wasn't a hardship for Dr. Grogg to continue to pay child support for three children, even though there were only two. But this does not follow the law, and it clearly doesn't follow the statute. So even if emancipation alone isn't a basis for modification, the modification statute 518A.39 subdivision 2 indicates that a substantial change in circumstances is a basis for modification. And it goes on to state that if the obligor can show, or the moving party can show, that child support will, applied to the new facts, will reduce support by $75 or 20%, that the moving party has made met the presumption that the award is unreasonable and unfair, and has met the rebuttal. Yes.
This is Judge Riley. I am trying to understand your position with regard to how subdivision 2 modification, which requires showing that the terms have become unreasonable and unfair, and subpart 8 talks about emancipation of a child, how that subdivision is read along with subdivision 5.
Well, subdivision 5, in my opinion, subdivision 5 stands alone and is a basis for modification of child support. Once a child emancipates, that is the change of circumstances, and now you apply the party's income to the guidelines and calculate child support. That is my position. But if the district court did not agree with that position, there's not case law that provides guidance on that issue. So then the next analysis is, if I'm incorrect and Dr. Grog needed to show substantial change in circumstance based on subdivision 2, then we have to go to the next analysis of, did he show that application of the new facts would reduce child support by at least $75 and 20%? Did he meet that standard? And yes, he did. His current child support obligation.
Ms. Frieders, yes. I understand, you know, what you just said, and that's how I read your brief. You're making two arguments in the alternative, and there's this second argument that even if we disagree with your interpretation of a subdivision 5 standalone motion, that you still think the district court erred and the decision should be reversed. What I'm struggling with, and you know, of course, that the respondent has argued that you forfeited or waived that issue. Even if I don't find you forfeited it or waived it because we have a decision from the district court about saying that the father did not sufficiently establish unreasonableness and unfairness of the terms, you didn't make this argument in district court. And there is substantial case law in Minnesota that suggests you can't change your theory on appeal. And it seems to me that's exactly what you're doing. You know, I read through all your submissions in district court, the entire transcript from the district court hearing, and you never asserted, Dr. Grog never asserted during district court proceedings that the current terms of the child support order were unreasonable and unfair.
So our motion specifically indicates that we were bringing the motion under Minnesota Statute 518A.39 Subdivision 2 and Subdivision 5. My motion specifically addresses that.
Yes, as I said, I'm not really focused on whether you forfeited it because I see those references and that you're making an alternative argument based on the district court's decision. What I'm concerned about is you're changing your theory. So right now you were just launching into why the record shows this 20% $75 substantial difference, right? I mean, you're just ready to launch into that. That's in your brief. I've read it. But you never made that argument to the district court judge. That was an argument that was made by Ms. Remington on behalf of her client that you didn't satisfy that 20% $75, but you never responded. So now you're asking us to take a view of this case that's quite different from the position that you took. You put all your eggs in the one basket that the district court had to strictly go under subdivision 5, and now you're switching. I'm just struggling with whether that's a proper for you to do on appeal. Is that even fair?
Okay, yeah. Procedurally, we brought a motion for modification of child support based on substantial change in circumstances approximately a year earlier. And the judge indicated that he did not think that there had been a substantial change in circumstances based on income alone. Mm-hmm. So when we came back to court based on emancipation, the judge was discussing with us his previous order. And so I emphasized the emancipation issue, but I did not waive substantial change in circumstances. I said in oral arguments, there has been a substantial change in circumstances. It was in our motion, but you are correct. I focused on the emancipation issue that is a substantial change in circumstances, and that we provided the income and the information. The district court judge then goes on to make a decision in this case, not addressing substantial change in circumstances, and
Let's go ahead and see whether the district court judge did address substantial change. You're right that our district court judge definitely understood your earlier challenge, right?
That
resolution that happened and was not appealed by Dr. Grogg, that the change in the guidelines did not render this child support, the terms of this child support order to be unreasonable and unfair. That no appeal was taken. The judge remembered that had all been resolved. We have that order in the record. Does that have law of the case value on this issue?
I don't believe so, because when you bring a motion for modification of child support, you look at the facts from the last time child support was established. And the only order that established child support is the original judgment and decree. There have been cost of living adjustments, but the standard is, has there been a change since child support was last established? And because the interim order did not modify support, I don't think that that's relevant to the analysis in this case.
How about for understanding the district court's decision in this case?
Yes, I think that it helps you understand the judge's mindset about substantial change in circumstances and whose burden of proof it is to deal with this.
And speaking of that, I mean, you make a very important argument about shifting the burden of proof to mother based on the rebuttable presumption on substantial change. And I want to give you time to talk about that. I noted the authorities that you cited for it, and they aren't family law cases. Has the Minnesota Supreme Court or Court of Appeals recognized the shifting of the burden of proof to the other party?
Not that I'm aware of. I did look for cases that discuss that, and it hasn't been addressed that I could find.
Right. In fact, I saw the opposite when I looked and my clerks looked. We found cases that said that the burden of proof, despite this business of there being irrebuttable and rebuttable presumptions, the burden of proof remains on the moving party. That's what the decisions appear to say without ever considering your argument, which is, does it shift? So give me your best shot at why it should shift. Because a presumption doesn't necessarily mean that the burden of proof shifts, at least not to my knowledge.
So it's a rebuttable presumption. My client does not wish to rebut that presumption and doesn't have the burden to rebut that presumption. It seems to be the non-moving party who does not want the support to be modified would have the burden to show that the modification is that it wouldn't be unreasonable and unfair. I don't know what the purpose of a rebuttable presumption would be if the moving party is required to rebut the presumption.
And I guess I'm not suggesting that that piece. It's more that I'm wondering how it affects the district court's decision. So the district court has to decide whether there has been a substantial change in circumstances that renders the existing order unreasonable and unfair. Those two things, substantial change and unreasonable and unfair, are tied together. And so the district court has to make this decision considering the presumption that
Correct.
Dr. Grogg gets.
Correct.
It doesn't necessarily mean because Dr. Grogg has the presumption that the district court just rules in Dr. Grogg's favor. District court still gets to make a decision based on the record, right?
But yes, Dr. Reck provided no evidence that in any way, shape, or form that she is any way that she cannot afford to support the children. She did not provide a budget, and her gross income is approximately $29,000 a month. She provided no evidence how it would be unfair to her, unreasonable or unfair for her to receive child support pursuant to the guidelines.
Right. But the district court's reasoning was a little different. You do suggest one path the district court could have taken in your comments, but that's not the path the judge took. Instead, the judge recognized two things, that there are many fixed expenses. This is generally true. The judge has experience in it. Nobody contended otherwise. Many fixed expenses. So the fact that one child's emancipated doesn't necessarily change the analysis that significantly. That's how the judge reasoned. That's not me talking.
Sure.
And then the second being that there was no evidence or suggestion that there were specific expenses that were changed as a result of the emancipation of the older child. So would you respond to that's the reasoning the judge gave? So that's what we need to contend with.
So and part of the, in addition, he said it wouldn't be a hardship to Dr. Grog. So
good point.
And that's not part of the analysis. So he says that he made an assumption that there are fixed expenses that wouldn't reduce Dr. Reck's needs. He made that assumption. Dr. Reck did not provide any evidence on that issue. So the judge made an assumption about that. We don't even know what Dr. Grog's budget is. We don't even know if she has a mortgage payment. So those are just major assumptions that were made. And the legislature has said there is a fixed amount of money that it assumes people or that it allots for child support. And it clearly says that you don't deviate above this amount. Unless you can show significant, substantial needs such as disability of a child. So there's that kind of analysis that the legislature has imposed in these cases. And my time is up.
There are further questions from the panel. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Remington, we'll turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Suzanne Remington, and I represent the respondent in this case, Dr. Reck. I'm going to start actually in reverse and I'm going to say my conclusion first, which is that the Court of Appeals should issue a published decision affirming Judge Chase's decision based upon the collective legal analysis set forth in four unpublished cases, Blazer, Hanratty, Borgon, and Gomez, and Judge Chase's own legal analysis. In addition, the court should publish and affirm Judge Chase's decision after a collective reading of 518.39 Subdivision 2A, Subdivision 2A8, and Subdivision 2B1, and Subdivision 5C. So when I went back and I read the briefs, I found them a bit confusing. And I thought, well, there's got to be an easier way to talk about this issue. And I think that there is. And I wish I would have put a chart in my brief, but I didn't. So I am going to overlay what I believe that the relevant law says about this particular case in modifying child support when there's an emancipation, et cetera.
So Ms. Remington,
yes,
if I may, could you cut to the chase? And at the beginning, and so am I, and perhaps you could incorporate the answer to this question as you summarize the law. But if you're asking us to issue a precedential opinion, So what would that syllabus point, or maybe there are a couple, what would those be from your perspective?
They would be address this. That? Yes, they would be this, Your Honor. And it would be to synthesize all of this unpublished law and to synthesize the statutes. This is what it should outline. One, a moving party who wants to modify child support, and I'm only talking about relevant situations to this particular case. They can claim, number one, that a child emancipated. They can claim, number two, that there's been a $75 change and a 20% change in a child support obligation. They can claim, number three, that the parties there's bargained for language in the judgment and decree that created an automatic reduction in child support upon the emancipation of a child. Those are three separate situations that will get you, those equal a substantial change in circumstance. That gets you over the first hurdle. this is what's the confusing part, Your Honors, which is the second step. And they talk about first step, second step. The second step is this finding of unreasonable and unfair. If you use the statute 518A39 subdivision 2A8 and you say a child's emancipated, the moving party still must prove that the existing child support order is unreasonable and unfair according to subdivision 2A. And then the third step would be that the district court must calculate child support using the current incomes of the parties, which is subdivision 5C. Now, let's take a look at the second substantial change in circumstance, which could be the $75 and 20% change as set forth in subdivision 2B1. If the obligor can prove that there is a presumption, like Ms. Frieder says, that it is presumed to be unreasonable and unfair. That is a situation where it is presumed to be unreasonable and unfair. When that happens, which I don't believe Dr. Grog argued at the court of, at the district court level, but that's just a different issue. The moving party then must prove, the non-moving party must prove that the order is reasonable and unfair. Okay. And that is what Dr. Reck did. And that is what Judge Chase found. Okay. The third situation that we have, which aren't, you know, we have a, if we had a judgment and decree that said something like this: upon the emancipation of our eldest child, Amy, child support shall be reduced to $500. That's an automatic reduction in child support that is bargained for, right? Clearly bargained for and in writing. Nobody has to prove unreasonable and unfair. And the court just needs to calculate child support based on the current incomes. I do believe that as Your Honors had stated, I have many concerns. Well, I'm going to hold that argument, Your Honor. So that is, I think, what you need to make clear about the case law in Minnesota. I think that reading of the unpublished cases in the statutes is simple, makes sense, implements the statutes as they should be. Ms. Frieders relies on subdivision 5C to say that emancipation is an automatic reduction in child support because the statute says shall use current incomes. Well, that just tells the district court what incomes it must use if it gets to the third step of calculating child support. There is nothing in Minnesota case law, and there is nothing in the statute that says that emancipation is an automatic reduction in child support. Another point that I think is a red herring that's being made by Ms. Frieders is this concept of upward deviation. But there's nothing in the statute that requires, when you're making an unreasonable and unfair argument or a reasonable and unfair argument, that you must prove all the factors set forth in the upward deviation statute. That's just a red herring. That argument doesn't belong in this courtroom here today. Switching to the factual part of this case, which is if the court is going to entertain that Mr. Grog actually made the argument of $75 and 20% change.
Counsel, I had stated a little differently. It's not so much that we're going to credit Dr. Grog with arguments that were or were not made in the record. We'll just look at the record and make a determination. But we do have a district court decision that decided that the existing child support order was not unreasonable and unfair, yes, and appears to somewhat perhaps give short shrift or to skip over the question of substantial change. So would you address Ms. Frieder's arguments in response to the district court's three-point analysis for why the existing terms are unreasonable, are not unreasonable and unfair?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. First of all, when you're the issue of substantial change, that hurdle is met when you can show a child emancipated. Okay. That is just equal to substantial change. Child emancipates equals substantial change. The next question is whether the existing order is unreasonable and unfair. All right. If you just look at Judge Chase's decision from 2020 and not the prior decision where he made very specific findings about incomes and fairness, et cetera, I really don't think he gave short shrift to the argument of unreasonable and unfair.
And I didn't mean to suggest that the district court did. It was on your first point that you've already addressed. Do you believe substantial change is fully addressed because the judge just goes ahead based on emancipation?
Yes.
So go ahead and talk about the district court's analysis of why the terms were not unreasonable and unfair. In our comment, my colloquy with Ms. Frieder's, she indicated there were three reasons the district court judge gave. I think that was accurate, but if you disagree, let us know.
Well, I think
her argument, as I heard it, was, well, fine, but there's nothing in the record to support the district court's determinations on any of those three points.
Well, let's all first acknowledge the fact that an abuse of discretion is a very high standard. And we have to look at what is in the record collectively. And there is a lot of information in the record when you go back to the 2019 order. So what Judge Chase was saying is, I've looked at this issue back in 2019, and no party said that the information from 2019 was stale. So the judge said, as you cited, that there are certain expenses of the mom of the respondent that haven't changed just because one child emancipates, right? That's common sense. Like, you know, the mortgage doesn't change, your car insurance doesn't change, your landline doesn't change. There's all kinds of expenses that don't change just because one child emancipates. I think what is more important, though, is when you look at this and people talk, there's talk about percentages. Dr. Grog does it and the court does it too. But if you look at this, Your Honor, in 2011, when the judgment and decree was issued, Dr. Grog had about $21,000 of gross monthly income. And in 2020, he had approximately $25,000 of gross monthly income. He wasn't even working full time. Now, if you look at that, that's important, right? Because we have a child support obligation that we should all remember was originally set back in 2011. Granted, there were small cost of living adjustments. But over the last 9 years, life has not gotten cheaper. It has gotten more expensive. And I think that's what Judge Chase's point is, which is, yes, Ms. Frieder's points out that his income, he was paying child support at 5.56% of his income at the time of the judgment and decree. And now he's paying 5.64% of his income. And my response is, yeah, so what? We have to look beyond that. We have to look at the age of the original order. We have to look at the amount of money he was making. And I think clearly, based on the entire record and the judge's 2019 decision, he made a decision well within his discretion to find that the order continues to be reasonable and fair. And I believe that is true. I have no doubt. I've never read district court decisions as well written and as thoughtful as Judge Chase writes. He's an honorable judge and a good man. And I just can't, if I put myself in his shoes, I just can't make an argument that he abused his discretion when he found that the order was still reasonable and fair to this particular family.
So, Ms. Remington, I want to make sure I heard you clearly when you were discussing what you thought the likely syllabus points would be in a published decision. I heard you to say that in a case such as this one, where it's undisputed that the difference does satisfy, the difference being the child support under current conditions, child support under the existing order, satisfies the 20% $75 standard, that as the statute says, we will presume the existing order is unreasonable and unfair. And you said the non-moving party must then prove, respond to that. So the rebuttable presumption does, as I heard you say, result in a shifting of the burden of proof.
I believe it does, Your Honor.
Okay. And so you agree with Ms. Frieders on that point. You also, do you have any case law that would suggest that that sort of decision has already been made or made in an analogous way in Minnesota?
I don't, Your Honor. I just read the plain language of the statute. But okay. I think what you need to do is be clear that that's the only substantial change in circumstance that shifts the burden. We need to be clear when it's emancipation, the moving party still needs to prove unreasonable, unfair, right? But when we've got the $75 and 20% change, yes, it does shift to the obligee. And I believe reading the statutes collectively, that is the intent. And it makes sense. It makes sense. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Any further questions from the panel for Ms. Remington? Then we'll turn to you, Ms. Breeders, for rebuttal.
Okay. I wish to point out that no budgets were submitted by Dr. Reck in the motion that we're talking about, nor was there a budget presented in the previous motion. So all of Judge Chase's comments about the cost of raising these kids is based on speculation. And he made no findings that were specific to the budget. And Ms. Remington said things like car insurance don't change when a child emancipates. Well, they do. That child is no longer a minor child on the family's insurance. And so there are changes to the budget when a child emancipates.
Ms. Frieders, do you agree with Ms. Remington that this should be a precedential case? And if you do, what would your syllabus point be?
I do believe that this should be a precedential case. I believe that emancipation of a child is a basis for modification without showing the substantial changes or the unreasonable and unfair part of the analysis. But if you disagree with me on that, I believe that the syllabus, it needs to be clarified that emancipation alone is not a basis and that the when you're making the analysis, has there been a substantial change in circumstances that renders the order unreasonable and unfair? There needs to be clarification about whose burden of proof it is to when that burden shifts. And I believe it should be the non-moving party's obligation. I think those are two issues that are not I don't think there's a lot of guidance in the decisions published or unpublished on those two issues.
I think Judge Chase agreed with you. He has such a great writing style.
Yes.
He said, an unreported case, and I will take guidance wherever I can find it.
Yes. Judge Chase is, I agree with Suzanne Remington. Judge Chase is a wonderful judge. He's my former partner. And I think the world of him. I just disagree with how he decided this case. And in this case, you know, the legislature changed the child support guidelines. The legislature made a Minnesota statute 518A.39. I'm getting lost in the subdivisions. Subdivision 2J states an enactment, amendment, or repeal of law constitutes a substantial change in circumstances for the purposes of modifying child support when the standards for modification and the statute apply. So one of the arguments has been, well, they agreed to child support based on the old law, but the legislature has made it clear that the new law should be applied to these modification cases. And the legislature has also made it clear that when applying the guidelines, that basic support should be based on the guidelines that currently exist, and that high earners are not required to pay above the guidelines unless there's a significant basis for doing so, such as the disability of a child or other sort, those types of unusual expenses, which do not exist here. And Judge Chase did not have sufficient information from Dr. Reck to determine that she can't afford to take care of the children with the guidelines established by the legislature. So we request that this be remanded with instructions to apply the guidelines to the facts of this case, either because emancipation in and of itself is enough, or because Dr. Grog has met the standard of substantial change in circumstances that renders the order unreasonable and unfair. And if Dr. Reck can provide evidence that there's, for some reason that, you know, she can provide the evidence and the judge can make the appropriate findings, so be it. But so far, she's not made any proof other than saying, I don't want to have support reduced. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. The briefing and arguments in this case were very well done and helpful to the court, so we very much appreciate that.
Thank you.
And we'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion in the statutory time period.